Do you remember the first time you made a phone call? Yeah, I can't either. But Puint Tun can. She was a young girl in rural Burma.
Because it was my dad was working in Malaysia, and you know, my mom said, "Okay, everybody, we're going to make a phone call." And then we all got dressed up.
This was in the early 80s.
We didn't have the phone at home, so we had to go to where the tower was, this microwave antenna. My grandparents live about 14 miles away, so we called them, and then also my dad. But I just remember, like, vividly, like, everybody got dressed up. I just remember, like, that first phone call as a really, really big deal.
This is Whose Century Is It? I'm Mary Kay Magstad. Puint's had quite a journey since then. She's now a telecommunications whiz and is helping Burma, now called Myanmar, get connected. And have they ever? Just 3 years ago, hardly anyone in Burma had a mobile phone. SIM cards were expensive and coverage was really patchy. Now, one in three Burmese has a mobile phone, one in five has a smartphone, and the numbers are climbing fast. The theme of this podcast is ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. And the power of getting connected is definitely one of those things. I mean, think about it. How often do you use your mobile phone, and for what? Text messages, sure. Checking Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram. Taking photos and videos and sending them to your friends and family. Checking news and weather and random interesting stuff. Listening to music, watching videos and movies, Skyping, getting directions, calling an Uber, playing games. And that barely scratches the surface. Hard to even remember when we didn't have all of that with us all the time, right? But it wasn't that long ago, really, even in the United States. And in Burma, that was something else again. The country was called Burma when I started covering it as a foreign correspondent based next door in Thailand in 1988. When I first got there, the Burmese military had just cracked down on pro-democracy demonstrators who'd been out in the streets for weeks calling for an end to the quirky authoritarian rule of a guy named General Nay Win. He was a military ruler, kind of anti-modern. He liked to consult fortune tellers to figure out what policies to enact. At one point, the fortune tellers told him he could face a threat from the right, so he should make a symbolic move in that direction to protect himself. He listened, he thought about it. And he decided to decree that traffic, which had been driving on the left side of the road in the British tradition, Burma had been a British colony, should switch to the right side of the road. To this day, it's on the right. Another time, the fortune tellers told him that 9 was a lucky number for him, a protective number. So he changed the country's currency system and put all units of currency in base 9. Seriously, the first time I visited Burma, there were notes in denominations of 15, 45, and 90. It was really hard making change. And all of this would be funny, except people who had the old currency lost a lot of money. And in general, Nay Win ruled through fear and violence. His army fought wars with more than a dozen ethnic minority insurgent groups, and hardly any new investment was coming in. So, for years, Burma was kind of a living time capsule. There were old colonial buildings in Rangoon, left by the British, that were kind of falling apart, but still kind of beautiful. There were vintage cars. I'm talking early 60s, because for years, newer cars weren't allowed to be imported. Out in the countryside, the scenes were even more timeless. That's where Puint grew up. That's why the new telephone tower, when it came in the early 80s, was such a big deal. And then her family moved to Rangoon. Puint was about 14 in 1988. Students and others started filling the streets in front of her family's apartment and calling for democracy.
So many students were integral in organizing this protest. So, I mean, some of the kids that were being shot down were maybe like 4 or 5 years older than me at most. Huh. So I felt like, you know, totally with them in spirit and wanted to go and be part of the protest. And a few of the days my mom allowed us to, but most of the time we were actually enclosed in behind the barbed wire because our apartment is next to the city hall.
The military opened fire on these students more than once, and by the time of the final crackdown by the military junta in September 1988, hundreds, possibly thousands, had been killed. An especially bloody day was August 8, 1988. That's 8-8-88. And it had been chosen as a day for national demonstrations because the fortune tellers said all these eights were auspicious. Well, not so much for the demonstrators who got shot. Your mom is a doctor?
Yes, she's a doctor.
And kind of helped out after some of the demonstrators were wounded.
Yeah. The people who were shot and bleeding didn't dare to go into the hospital because that was like a straight way of going straight into jail. So a lot of them looked for alternative ways of getting help. So my mom and her students set up a clinic at the basement of a church.
Because of her helping the demonstrators, your family felt that you needed to leave.
Yes, that was pretty much the main reason because my mom was very politically active. She protested herself, and she was organizing this clinic, which supporting any protesting students pretty much is taking a stand against the government.
So the family got out. First, Puint's mother and little sister, and then the rest. Lots of Burmese were fleeing then. Puint and her family ended up in a refugee camp with many of them on the Thai-Burmese border.
I couldn't speak any Thai. And Burmese and Thai were very different. I was struggling trying to figure out how to do a self-study because my mom couldn't afford to send me to international schools, which were very expensive. Physics and chemistry were really tough.
But then Puint met a woman from Seattle who was working with refugees on the border. The woman saw that Puint was bright and offered to tutor her in physics and chemistry. She did well. The woman sponsored her to come to Seattle and go to college. Puint got a degree in engineering and focused on telecommunications. Her first job was at Sprint, selling packages for long-distance calls.
Because the perks that they give you free long-distance calls as an employee.
She called her mom and sisters back in Thailand and her grandparents inside Burma.
I was so homesick. That was what I was missing so much, that connectivity, just being able to hear their voice.
But what she was hearing from her grandparents about what life was like in Burma under the junta wasn't good.
They constantly lived in fear.
Like, there was the time she was talking to her grandpa.
There was like a third person who was listening in on the phone calls and interjecting things. So you can kind of tell this like Orwellian environment where people were so afraid that, you know, they can be arrested at any time because people are listening in all conversations.
And that's how it was for Puint's family and for millions of others for years. The woman who'd emerged as a pro-democracy leader in those heady demonstrations in 1988, Aung San Suu Kyi, spent many of those years under house arrest. The junta was uneasy about her popularity and certainly about her pedigree. She was the daughter of Burma's independence hero, kind of like their George Washington. This hero, Aung San, had been assassinated before he could really do much as the leader of the country. Aung San Suu Kyi had ideas about how to move the country forward, but the military didn't want to listen. And then it all started to change. They released Aung San Suu Kyi from house arrest in 2010. They started talking to her. Tight authoritarian rule started to loosen. A new generation of leaders had come up the ranks, and they were more pragmatic. They looked at the fact that Burma's half-century of isolation hadn't helped it much, and they felt that over-reliance on China, which had been the case since the 1988 crackdown, wasn't healthy for the country's national interests. And so Burma, now called Myanmar, started to open up. And Puint, who had in the interim worked at T-Mobile and had helped to create the first Android phone, had ideas about how to bring it all home.
I mean, I had always dreamed of being able to bring connectivity to Burma in one form or another. And then at that time, I asked around why the SIM cards were $500 to $1,000 and tried to go and meet with the incumbent state operator, this mobile network operator called MPT, which was the only one, just to figure out like why it was so expensive and what's going on. I met with the guy who was running the training school and see is there anything I can help, given my knowledge and expertise in technology, you know, share that knowledge from how running a telecom operator works. I realized that after meeting with amputee that it's not going to be an easy change to get them to see things a little bit differently. There was so much graft, so much corruption. The equipment manufacturers were selling, the vendors were selling the same equipment to Burma for a lot more than how much it's worth, and giving the kickbacks to these corrupt individuals in the ministry. So that was what shocked me. So I just said, okay, if with that much corruption that's ingrained, it's not going to be easy to change.
Like,
it's
how
not
much over actual cost were they?
Like three to four times.
3 to 4 times. And that money would go into the pockets of those in the ministries?
I think certain parts, yeah. And then there was no performance indicators around, you know, the network's performance. I couldn't get any information out, so.
Quint says back then, her aunt paid more than $1,000 for her SIM card, a fortune in Burma. And even with that, coverage was so patchy that she had 2 spots where she could stop the car when driving between Rangoon and her home village to make important calls. Even for foreign visitors, and I say even because the government started to actively court foreign investors, it wasn't easy making phone calls and getting a decent internet connection. When I visited in 2012, there were 2 hotels known for having fast internet because they didn't have to go through the gateway filter. Censorship, basically, that was in place for the rest of the country. Clearly, a little deregulation was in order. And finally, it happened.
It has been a really, really exciting to change to see, because since the deregulation did happen in Myanmar, it has gone from very little connectivity to one of the fastest growing mobile connectivity pretty much in the history for some of the telecom operators. Even Telenor, which has operated markets in Pakistan and Bangladesh and Thailand, they said the rapid ramping of growth in Myanmar exceeded all other markets that they've ever worked in.
Telenor
is Norwegian company.
Norwegian.
Yeah.
And the government's kind of let this happen? It's not censoring? It's not tapping into people's phones anymore? Or is it?
I think that's a very good question. There's a national gateway filter that's operated but managed by the individual mobile network operators themselves.
What difference have you seen this make in people's lives?
It's made humongous differences in people's lives, because not only are people, for the first time, are connected to their families, they're using their mobile phones for their businesses. They're not having to travel as much, travel as far to get information. Being next to China, they have access to very, very inexpensive $25 smartphones from China. Instead of even going with the feature phones, people are jumping straight onto smartphone, because this is the very first consumer device that majority of the population in rural area are investing in. For a lot of the people, they're using solar panels to be able to charge their phone. And you ask them, why do they have solar panels, inexpensive solar panels from China? Number one is for light. Number two is to charge their cell phone.
I love the idea that Chinese knockoff smartphones and cheap solar panels are empowering rural Burmese after so many years when China's support for the Burmese junta helped keep Burma isolated and many rural Burmese oppressed. Some were press-ganged into helping the military fight its wars against ethnic insurgents. Women were in danger of rape and violence if a military unit came through the villages. How times change. The girl from rural Burma who dressed up to make her first phone call 30-plus years ago, whose family had to flee Burma because her mother, the doctor, helped treat pro-democracy demonstrators, took officials from Myanmar's Ministry of Communications and Information Technology to Africa on a fact-finding mission about 3 years ago to learn about yet another way mobile phones could help the masses back home.
I was in Tanzania and Kenya in the very early days of this really exciting mobile money product called M-Pesa, the launch of M-Pesa. I was just happened to be there on vacation and just saw this, how transformative it was in so many people's lives. And I followed it very closely, this mobile money service that allows people to transfer money back and forth all using a mobile phone and conduct transactions. It creates a social safety net for the people who are the poorest.
So how so?
I mean, if you're someone who is in has a medical emergency come up and you don't have enough cash, instead of taking a huge loan out or selling, taking your daughter, dropping her out of school, just so that you can manage this crisis, you can call around different family members or relatives and ask them to transfer money to you as a loan, so that the loan doesn't have to be where they're based physically anymore. It's more widespread. So wherever they have families or relatives from other parts of the country can help them. And that, I think, is what I would love to see. I wanted the people in Burma to have the same access to mobile money services.
And you also looked at micropayments.
Yes.
Which are?
Micropayments are using mobile phones to conduct different business transactions. And
you were seeing this being used in markets in Tanzania, like to buy rice or to buy vegetables, you know, just for purchases of a few cents.
That's right. Yeah, the mobile money is used for everything. It was really bringing the whole country together in a way as well, because that makes it really easy to conduct business transactions for people who are not in the same location. So people who are trading can sell a product to someone not necessarily in the same area and be able to get more money for it. Hmm. So this mobile payment platform, M-Pesa, was really transformative for people in both Kenya and Tanzania, and Tanzania in particular, because there was so much competition that the transaction costs for these mobile money transactions were much lower in Tanzania in compared to Kenya, where it originated.
And when did this start?
This started in 2008, early 2008, late 2007. So when Burma started to do this telecom deregulation process, started to talk about doing this, I went and met with both the Central Bank of Myanmar and then the Ministry of Communications and IT, and just says, let's try to figure out a way to really leapfrog forward and learn from places like Tanzania, and let's not miss the boat. Because Burma has no payment system, no widespread payment system, versus this would be, along with the leveraging the connectivity revolution, you can connect everyone financially as well. And this is kind of like where Apple Pay and Google Pay, the mobile wallets, is this next step that many people in like developed countries are now moving towards. Anyhow, I just said, let's leverage, jump directly to mobile wallets and mobile payment platforms for Burma.
And they listened to you.
I've been very, very fortunate to have some very progressive friends in the ministries at the very key positions.
So, I mean, it's interesting because for so many years and even decades in Burma, the military has been, if I may use the term, defensive about its position. You know, it's been wary about technologies and changes in legislation that empowers the population to their detriment, where they're no longer as much in control as they used to be. And yet they've let all this happen, which certainly empowers the population. Why? What do you think was behind that? I mean, you've interacted with many people who are in the ministries, with the government. What do you think the thinking was as they went through this process?
The number one thing was the demand from the citizens. Many of the populations in Myanmar actually go and work as migrant workers in Thailand and Malaysia, where they have seen how connected the populations in those neighboring countries are and how affordable it is. So many people in Burma wanted the same thing. And the president, Thein Sein, when he came into power, he looked at what is a quick win, what and transformative for the population. And he decided that telecom would be one of the sectors that he would focus on.
In a way, though, there was also an equally extraordinary transformation in the attitudes of government. I mean, because to say this was a quick win and they were being responsive to the population already suggests that they felt that they needed to be responsive to the population, which hadn't seemed to be the case before.
Right. So I think the president, Thein Sein, I think he himself came from one of the villages that was impacted by Cyclone Nargis. And I think he must have seen some of the impact of, you know, the lack of action in his own villages, and he must have heard it from his own families as well. So in some ways, he's probably more connected to the population.
Cyclone Nargis was in 2008. It was a disaster twice over, the cyclone itself, and then the weird way the government responded, by blocking foreign relief aid from getting to the affected areas. And this came just a few months after yet another round of pro-democracy demonstrations, when another bunch of demonstrators got shot. In the midst of all this, Burmese were losing patience with the status quo. And within the government, within the military, a new generation of leaders was starting to think differently about how to move forward. Now, that's not to say that there's nothing but a happy ending at this point. The military is still holding on to a good deal of power. There are still tensions and sometimes open conflict with ethnic insurgent groups. And there's been a harsh crackdown on Rohingya Muslims. More than 1 million live in Myanmar, some with roots going back more than a century. But many Burmese call them Bengali, the place from which their ancestors came, and say they don't belong. There's been ethnic cleansing in recent years, and that's caused many Rohingya to flee, many more to live in refugee camps with limited rights. These are all issues for the new government to work through when it comes to office in March. The National League for Democracy, which is Aung San Suu Kyi's party, won a landslide victory in the November elections. And Puint thinks that here, too, getting connected is part of the solution.
The coverage in the ethnic minority areas still need to be increased drastically for them to be able to get understanding and information around what's going on, for them to be able to report in if there's a fighting. Just, I think since the telecom revolution happened, people understand more of what's happening in the different ethnic regions, a lot more than ever before. And so that bringing everyone together under one umbrella in some ways is really important. Actually, especially around the election time frame, people were reporting this particular most recent election. People were taking pictures and then uploading them on Facebook. And Burmese have completely embraced Facebook.
And how are people using Facebook? Is it just like to share things with friends, or is it more as a public site for posting, this is what's happening in my area, this is what this corrupt local official did? Is it sort of a watchdog role as well as a, you know, sort of personal sharing site?
So it's actually both a watchdog site as well as to share news and share their personal lives. So it's all three combined.
And Facebook is not blocked or censored in Burma?
It is not.
As it is in China.
That's right. So people, we're not only just getting this mobile phone connection, it's really this connectivity and the social network through Facebook and Viber. It's kind of like WhatsApp, to be able to send text messages and images to each other in a very effective way.
This is really incredible because a lot of the ethnic minorities have been fighting for 60 plus years. They've been on the border. They've been isolated. When they have had contact with ethnic Burmese, it's usually Burmese soldiers, and it's usually people clearing them out of their villages and being violent. They now get familiar with others in Burma, the way of life in Burma, what's happening elsewhere in the country. Do you think this is moving things toward, you know, possible reconciliation more quickly?
I would hope so. Actually, I think for me, what's really exciting is being able to connect all these different civil society leaders together from different parts of the country doing their own projects. Once you get them connected, they can share knowledge much more effortlessly. For example, one region, land confiscation happened. This is the lawyer. This is how she approached it. And I think it can really actually bring a lot more transparency.
There's not much pushback from the government.
Recently, there's been a few cases of people arrested over their Facebook post sharings. But both cases that I know about have to do with more of somebody's post offended the commander-in-chief. For example, one young woman, she compared the new uniform color of the military to the sarong color of what Aung San Suu Kyi was wearing. She's still in jail, as far as I know. And another...
Wait, why would that be so offensive?
There's this concept of pong, or like the spiritual current that determines someone's power. So the Burmese considered poem as one of the very important part of the psyche, and then for a man's to be compared to a woman's lower part of the body will reduce his poem or his spiritual power.
So then how do you think these guys are feeling about Aung San Suu Kyi now being in a position of power, even though it's still technically unofficial under the current constitution, which doesn't allow her to be president, but she's head of the party that won a massive victory in the election?
There is no way for the military to deny the results of this most recent election. But in many ways, the military thought that they were the military party, USDP, was going to win landslide. Up until like the week before the election or the few days before the election, that it shows the disconnect that the military has from how average citizen really felt towards them.
The 1990 election, I was there as the votes were being counted. And then, I mean, I'm sure they also thought they were going to win. Amazing to me that they allowed the actual count to be made public. It was like 85% of the vote going to the NLD and to related parties, associated parties. But then they said, but we're not handing over power. What do you think made this time so different?
So, I mean, I should say the transition is not completed yet. We are still kind of in the wait and see stage. I would feel a lot more relieved when NLD government is in power in, say, March of this year to say that the election was successful, because this is still in the negotiation stage. Even if NLD becomes the government,
You said if. You're not entirely confident.
Just based upon what happened in 1990.
Sure. So if?
If and when, hopefully, when NLD is in the government, the Border Guard Patrol, military, the Ministry of Home Affairs, these guys don't roll up to report to the president. So it can still be that the military actually still manages and has control over the country. So, for example, even if NLD president say we don't want there to be any wars at the border, he or she will have no authority to stop the military from bombing the ethnic regions.
Huh.
So because the commander-in-chief does not report to the president, that is actually the major flaw in the Myanmar's constitution. There can be a war and the president is completely unable to stop it. There can be a civil war and the president cannot reel in the military.
Wow. How do you think this transition, however it might unfold, will affect the process of trying to connect Burma?
I really hope that Burma can learn from places like Indonesia in terms of transition from the military-led role into a much more civilian government role, rather than learning from a place like Pakistan. Because, I mean, if you look at Pakistan, where the military is still very entrenched, and look where it is versus, I think, looking at where Indonesia is now, it gives me a lot more hope. The Indonesian military and the way they had transitioned has really transformed Indonesia as a country economically, and many people have generated a lot more wealth. But in terms of connectivity, I feel like it can only help and not hurt. The more transparency there is, the more openness there is, the more connected the citizens are, the more connected the military is to the citizens, and remove them from this isolation of how the rest of the country is feeling, it can only move the country towards a much more positive direction.
Flint has definite ideas about what that positive direction should look like. She says connectivity and technology like M-Pesa can change the equation for women, especially rural women, who now struggle to get bank loans and credit. That's one thing. Another is that Burmese are already using their mobile phones to take free online classes to leapfrog into the 21st century and all its technologies after being held back for half a century in the 20th. There's incredible energy in Myanmar these days, and it's made greater by the new connectivity throughout the country and with the rest of the world. The possibilities seem endless,
The challenges are great. But the door is now open for Myanmar to make its mark as a modern nation in the 21st century. And that's our podcast. Visit our website, pri.org/century, to hear other episodes, or go to iTunes and subscribe. You can also find us on SoundCloud and Stitcher. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in partnership with the BBC and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Come on back and listen in.